Our opening words come from Chief Seattle. Teach your children what we have taught our children, that the earth is our mother. Whatever befalls the earth befalls the sons and the daughters of the earth. If men spit upon the earth, they spit upon themselves. This we know, the earth does not belong to us. We belong to the earth. This we know, all things are connected. Whatever befalls the earth befalls the sons and the daughters of the earth. We do not weave the web of life. We are merely a strand in it. Whatever we do to the web, we do to ourselves. I welcome everyone on this incredibly beautiful fall morning. I welcome you whether you come weary seeking comfort or come eager seeking a vibrant connection to meaning or both. Whether this is your first or second or third time, or if you've been coming for 40 years, you are welcome here at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. I share these words from Tecumseh to inspire us to enter into the meaning of our lighting of the chalice, a symbol of Unitarian Universalism. When you rise in the morning, give thanks for the morning light. For your life and strength, give thanks. Give thanks for your food and the joy of living. So in that spirit, with that heart, we light our chalice. We need your help. Our first hymn this morning is a round. It's gathered here. We'll sing it three times, but not as a round. They'll lead us. So stand as you're able, and let us sing gathered here at number 389.
Gathered here in the mystery of the hour. Gathered here in one strong body, gathered here in the struggle and the power, Spirit, draw near. Gathered here in the mystery of the hour, gathered here in one strong body, gathered here in the struggle and the power, Spirit, draw near. Gathered here in the mystery of the hour, gathered here in one strong body, gathered here in the struggle and the power, Spirit, draw near.
I draw your attention to the announcements in our order of service. And I would like to share that after the service that Ron Parks' wife, Judy Parks, will be selling the book that Ron will be presenting today. So take a look at it and buy it. Ours is a welcoming community where we find and seek connection, a loving community where we find meaning. Ours is a sharing community where our joys are amplified, a caring community where our sorrows are lessened. We take this moment to reflect on our joys and sorrows and acknowledge the mutual support of our community. I would like to share that Marissa Larson, a member of this fellowship, found out Friday morning that her father had died of an aneurysm. So that's a great and quick loss. So if you can, send her a card or wish her well in whatever way you so please. If you would like to share a brief verbal expression of a special joy or sorrow, this is the time to do so now.
Mickey Ray, I wanted to review Ron's book for the Mercury, but somebody beat me to it. But I will say it was a joy to read, and I think you'll all learn a lot about where we are and who is here before us.
Yesterday was my dad's birthday.
Hello, I'm Elke Lorenz, and I'm happy to announce that my son Thomas and his wife Mary are expecting their second child, and the baby will be born in April.
May we remember those who have spoken, those they have named, and those who hold sorrows and joys in the silence of their hearts. Now's the time for the story for all ages, so I, as always, need lots of help, so please come on up. Good morning, everyone. Kind of waking up still? Yeah. All right. The name of my story is My Little Blue Bird. Sarah was 7 years old. Is anybody here seven? All right. So you know what it's like to be seven. She lived with her mom and dad in a far-off place called Topeka. Her grandparents lived out in the Flint Hills. Sarah loved to visit them. She liked helping her grandmother in the garden to pick tomatoes or cucumbers or pull up the onions, all that fun stuff that grandma does in the garden. And she loved it when there was a calf that needed to be fed by a bottle or a bucket of milk. She would bring that bucket of milk to a calf whose mother didn't have enough milk to feed her, and she would bring the bucket of milk into the barn, and then she would gently nudge the calf's head into the milk so that it would taste it and would say, "Come on, little one, drink the milk. Come on, you can do it." And then slowly the calf would learn how to drink out of a bucket. She just loved those kinds of things. She loved being on the farm, and her grandparents looked so forward to having her come and visit. It made her feel so light and happy and filled with joy to be out there in the grand open spaces. But this time when she arrived at her grandparents, a place she loved with all her heart, she felt sad. Her grandparents asked her what was wrong. Sarah said, "Nothing really. I just don't feel so good." Grandmother asked, "Would you like to lay down and rest for a while?" "No, I don't want to lay down. I'll just go sit by the big oak if that's okay." "All right, you know where it's at. Just be careful." Sarah went out the back door and walked to the big oak next to the meadow that just stretched out and rolled for acres and acres. She looked out into the meadow, and out of the corner of her eye, she saw a flash of blue. This made her remember what happened last week when she told Sam, her very best friend at school, something very special to her. She started to cry. And as she put her head in her hands and cried, she felt her grandfather's hand on her shoulder. And grandfather asked Sarah, "May I sit with you?" "If you want." So, Sarah, what's happening, Grandfather asked. Why are you so sad? Oh, I don't know. Oh, I think you do, Grandfather said. I think you do know why you're sad. Will you please tell me? Oh, I don't. Okay, I'll tell you. The last time I was here and sitting on this rock, and I was just letting the sun hit me, and I was so happy, I closed my eyes, and I heard the bluebird singing that wonderful upper register song like Grandma sometimes sings in the garden when she's really happy. And it made me happy, so I closed my eyes, and I imagined myself flying up there with the bluebird and singing my heart out. And it made me feel as if I were flying and floating all over the meadow and the woods, and I just felt so special. I felt I was just like the bluebird. And when I told Sam, oh, my God, what a mistake. He just blabbed it around everybody. Oh, there's the bird girl. She thinks she can fly. Isn't that funny? And it made Sarah feel so small and so heavy and so hurt. So she told her grandfather all of this. And her grandfather said, when you were a little one, I held you in my arms. I called you my little bluebird. And when you could first walk, we came to this rock and we watched the bluebirds. Do you remember? No, not really. But you were my little bluebird. And you know why you were my little bluebird? Because you were always happy and singing and skipping and doing all the things that I love about bluebirds. Bluebirds don't fight other birds unless a blue jay comes and tries to attack their nest or do something like that. Then the bluebirds get really angry and they just chase that bluebird, that blue jay away. So they're not afraid of defending themselves. But they're peaceful birds. They're birds that love to live in the place they live. And so, Sarah, do you know why I called you my little bluebird? Well, maybe. Well, honey, let me tell you something. You are my little bluebird, and I want you to know you have a right to be happy. You have a right to fly as high as you want to and imagine what you want to imagine and to feel what you want to feel as long as it is safe and good. And imagination can take you to the most amazing places. So you are my little bluebird and you are a source of great happiness to me. So the little bluebird started to smile. And they watched the sky and the trees and the meadow and the birds fly over. And again, they felt at home with one another. So I hope that you feel so good about yourselves that sometimes you feel like you can fly. So let's fly to our classes. In all you do, when love our hearts are with you, go in joy, our hopes go to, learn in love and grow in wisdom, share your life in all you do. On the eve of the final departure to Oklahoma, the Kansa said goodbye to their white friends by presenting them with tomahawks, pipes, bows, and arrows, photographs of themselves. May we give so generously from our lives when we have lost almost everything.
would like to say just a couple words before I start the buffalo drum meditation. It's a very special buffalo skull that was given to me by a friend with the buffalo herd, Charlie Smyes. The buffalo drum is of the hide of a buffalo that I just got. And the drum is the heartbeat, and the rattles are the spirit. And the rattles are the turtle, representing Mother Earth, and the little jingle rattle is the dancer, which could be human or non-human. And this is a meditation, so at the end it could be a silence of the meditation. Thank you.
12 years ago, I led a worship service at White Memorial Camp for the Kansas cluster of Unitarian Universalist congregations, and it was the first time I realized that I needed to ask for forgiveness for my relatives immigrating and taking over the land of the Kansas people. And that was an amazing moment of recognition. I don't feel like it's something that you finish. You're just always in the middle of saying, I'm sorry, forgive me. Outside my window, my study window, I can see the last fort built by the military to defend the settlers from Kansas Indians. And there are little windows where you can see where the guns sat to shoot Native people. Every time I go by it and am aware enough, I feel something of the darkness and horror that that place represents. I met Ron Parks in a Prairie book study group about 10 years ago, 9 years ago, something like that. And we were reading books about the ecosystem and the prairie. And then I began to know Ron and his true and deep dedication to the Kansas story. And then I began to receive articles and newspapers that he had found by really tedious research into all the newspapers that might have had articles about the Kansas Indians. And they were such gifts to find and open up and to read. These passages from 1860s and 40s, or not 40s, 50s, that time period. And they would come like once a month, this gift in the mail, this gift of knowledge, this gift of connection. So one might call Ron's efforts to create this amazing book a labor of love, but that would be dismissive. Because really what it is at its heart is a deep, deep dedication to truth and finding a way to share that truth as you discover it. So this process of writing this book is a long and arduous and wonder-filled journey. We are so lucky to have this man in our midst to share something of his seeking, something of his finding, and to remind us that we are just a strand in the interconnected web of resistance. So it is my great honor and with great affection I welcome Ron Parks.
Good morning. Thank you, Pat and Michael. Thank you for being here, wanting to be here. The mystery of this hour, I love that phrase. I had not run across that. That's great. The mystery of this hour. Wow. Yeah. Well, the book was published in April of this year by the University of Oklahoma Press, and I have had an opportunity to talk at different places throughout the state about the book and do book signings, and that's been a really nice experience. And I do have a talk. Now, I have variations depending on the audience, but I do have this talk that I give. But Michael has encouraged me to be, and with my full assent, more introspective about this one with you. Okay? So this isn't going to emphasize the history as much as I ordinarily do, although the history will be extrapolated. This will be about this journey of authoring this book and reflections about that process as best as I can do that. And let me tell you, this is an existential moment here in terms of I don't have this written out. So to try to reflect honestly with you some of the joys and difficulties and challenges and tensions of creating this work is a moment, a pretty intense moment for me. But thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for the invitation, or at least I feel that there's an invitation to do that, to go that route this one time, and this will be, I think, the one time that I'm going to do this sort of thing. I want to say because this, you know, the title of the book is The Darkest Period, and so there's a, you know, there is a density, a heaviness to this story. That's just part of it. It's part of what I confronted and worked through every day. Starting 2007, I got serious about this. Now, I'd been at the Call Mission and interpreting this story from 1990 to 94, and then from 99 to 2004. So I had done some history, or I had done some research, and obviously had a kind of an interpretive form that I followed. But about 2007, I felt compelled to really get serious about this story, and to really claim it as my own, to go to the newspapers, the government documents, the journals, the letters, and to go throughout the Kansas range of their territory in Kansas, visit libraries and historical societies and museums, ferret out photographs, and get anything I could get that would tell the story. One of the problems with this whole research is that of many of the tribes, the Kansa were overlooked. There's not that kind of massive documentation. You didn't have ethnographers and people out here that were recording, interviewing, studying, living with, like you did some of the other tribes. And there also is, and this is reflected in just about every aspect of the Euro-American experience with the Kansas during the period that the book describes, 1846 to 1873. There is such a deep, abiding contempt for these people that it doesn't occur to anyone that they're worth the study. So that's a challenge. That's one of the challenges. But, you know, there have been some really good things that have happened here. There's been tremendous support for this project from a lot of different folks, a lot of different people. The call people, the call nation. I've had a relationship with the leaders of the call nation headquartered in Call City, Oklahoma. They are the formal tribal organization of the Kansa or Kansa. And they embraced my telling as best I could from my 21st century white guy's perspective. They embraced that. Which amazes me, astounds me. Speaking of the mystery of the hour. But it happened. I would not have proceeded with this without the support, encouragement, the facilitation of the call nation and the call people. This would not have happened. Couldn't have. I wouldn't have done it. But that was there. And there were a lot of people that encouraged me very early on in this process. I've got a BA in English from Kansas State University in 1972. I don't have academic credentials, in other words. I don't have an extensive publishing history. Okay? I mean, I wrote articles for newspapers and a few historical periodicals like Wagon Tracks, the Santa Fe Trail Association, but I don't have academic credentials for this sort of thing. And so there was a lot of doubts here about who am I to do this? You know, this is, and I had people who, plus I'm going to confess here, I had a healthy skepticism about academics based on some experiences, or maybe an unhealthy skepticism. As it turned out, misplaced, because some very well-established people who were experts in this field were the most encouraging in terms of, no, do it. You can do this. And there's a shift, and that's one of the things. You go into something with some biases, and then you have your mind and open to, no, actually, these are pretty good people here. They're not totally dedicated to one-upmanship and so forth. Michael Nelson, I remember having a conversation with him just as I was beginning the research, and I don't know, Michael, this is not gonna work. You know, I'm in over my head. I can do articles, but the book, we're talking about complexity here, in really extracting the information, putting it into chapter form, providing a structure in terms of chronological development as well as a thematic unit so that each chapter can stand alone and that this thing works as a piece. Okay? This is some of you have had this experience. This is you know, there is a level of complexity that I had not confronted before, and as an intellectual exercise. Michael Nelson was there and saying, "No, you're not over your head." Yeah, you know, he's pretty confident, and I wasn't. So anyway, I'm very grateful for that. So I did find people who encouraged me, and that was very nice. So in terms of what I was trying to, what kinds of issues I had to resolve to get this into a form that worked for me and I hope for the reader. Obviously, it needed to have a rigor, an intellectual scholarly rigor, and I was happy to accept that kind of discipline. That's fine. I don't quarrel with that in terms of the kind of establishing a factual basis, extrapolating themes, providing historical context, an analysis that is sound and based on other people's scholarship, and no problem with that process at all. I think that is time tested, and there's a reason that that's in place. And I did adhere to that. That's why I went to the University of Oklahoma Press. I knew that that would be a part of what they required, and they did. But they were great to work with too. But I'm after something else here too, because I certainly don't have any, or did not, and still don't have any academic ambitions or anything like that. There had to be a sense of the magic of story in this. The people had to surface. As much as I was able to get that to happen, there had to be a narrative pulse. In other words, there had to be a heart. There had to be a heart here. In thinking that through and trying to resolve sound scholarship, compelling story, and pulling that together, and that's the ambition of this. Whether it succeeded or not is up for the reader to decide, but that's the ambition of this book, to realize both. And I've lost my thread. I was going somewhere, and I've lost my thread. So who was my audience? Okay, it wasn't, academics weren't the audience, although they're most welcome to read the book, but that's not the primary audience. I was in historic sites for 23 years with the Kansas State Historical Society. At Hayes for 7 years and a couple of stints at the Call Mission for 8 or 9 years. Thousands and thousands of people came through my sites, and I talked to these people about the history of the sites, the themes, and we had conversations. Now, you know, about 90% of the people that come to a historic site are looking for a diversion, and they're there, they're happy to be there, they're great people for the most part. I mean, it's a positive experience because they, for whatever their background is, they're motivated to come to your site. They want to be there, but perhaps not particularly interested in an in-depth grasp of what you're trying to tell them. But about 10% of the people that came to those sites were... They had questions, they were engaged in conversations, they wanted to know more, they were fascinated, they were emotive. There was a relationship that could take place, and that was great. That was a great part of that job, was to engage people in a meaningful conversation where you were locked in on a subject of mutual concern, of mutual interest. And that's who I wrote this book for. I had that audience in mind the whole time. They're intelligent. They want it to be accurate. They want it to be to have a high standard of scholarship. But they want a story. They want to connect here with what's happened, with what's being described. Okay, there's no pretense of this being some sort of detached social science experiment, and which is fine. I mean, there's value on that too. But that's not what this process, which is an extension of my professional life that is infused in the book itself. That's all a piece. I knew who I was writing the book for, and that really helped because I knew that audience. And that really, really helped. One of the things that I really wanted to happen here was to for the reader to see people as people, which seems simple enough, you know, but actually it seemed like a monumental undertaking to see the Kanza, the calls, the Konza. You got different spellings and pronunciations for this tribe. I use Kanza because that's the spelling that the Kaw Nation has used in most of their historical publications of the last 10 years or so. So I'm emulating the tribe, following their leadership on that. But what you run across, and I alluded to this earlier, what you run across over and over again is that the Kanza are not seen as people by their contemporary Euro-Americans. And what happens is you become more aware as you research and see what's going on in this world, the third quarter of the 19th century, in this place that we call Kansas, is that what people have in their minds obscure, distort, corrode the possibility for realizing a common humanity. It's an astonishing phenomenon, and not that, you know, we don't have examples of it each and every day in our contemporary life, but to see that expressed over and over and over again and instance after instance, it's being pummeled by the human capacity for ignorance and misunderstanding. It's just the concentrating on evil and stupidity, basically. You get beat up. That's part of this process. You get beat up with it. But you can identify a couple of things here. You can identify a couple of ideas that people have got firmly implanted in their minds that then create this image of the other, in this case, the Kanza, the call. And we're going to let's just put it in two pervasive and powerful forces that grip the Euro-American mind: manifest destiny. You've all heard of it. This is an erudite group, okay? Manifest destiny. It is the white Christian Americans' not only duty but destiny to go forth and conquer the wilderness, which includes the indigenous peoples, because God wants that to happen. Okay, it's providential. It's a providential mission. That is not just something that historians have come up with as as an interpretive theme. It acts on the essential ways that people see the world, each other, and the way they treat each other. Attendant to that, implicit in that, is white racial supremacy. Race, there we go. Again, my God, it is unbelievable the intractable, absolute confidence that white Americans had that they were far and beyond a better people than those others. And it comes across in just about every form of expression. If you want to, I'm not going to go into that here. It's in here, though. It's in here. And so you have these ideas, and it's a cultural situation then, because people are puppeteered by these controlling ideas that nobody seems to, few people, want to challenge. And so the whole conditioned, reactive experience of Americans in this period, it's like the script is already preordained. You know what's going to happen because you know what the controlling ideas that they're going to act from and perceive from. And so there it is. I guess that's the definition of tragedy. People are on a track they can't get off of. They can't see. And sure enough, it just unfolds according to those deeply implanted, deeply felt ideas that the colonizers had in their minds and hearts and imaginations when they came to this part of the world. So events extended were just extensions, were just manifestations of what had already had been taken place in the imaginations of people. So how, all right, here's the problem as author. Now, you've got to be able to detach. You can't get too messianic here. You can't become so wrapped up in the horror and in your reaction to this, that then the book itself would turn into a polemic. It would turn into something that is a kind of a self-indulgent exercise of white man's guilt and then there's another thing, a problem with this in terms of the emotional part of it, and that is that you can become extremely judgmental of the conquerors to the point where you dehumanize them because and then feel righteous about it out of that anger. Okay, so author, how do you manage that? Because that's there. I'll tell you what, I'm going to fess up to you. There's rage here. But you can't let that be the dominating force, the energy that's behind the narrative form that proceeds from your imagination. You can't do it. So there has to be, and there's, you know, that tension between the intellect and the emotion, the heart and the mind, and you're trying to embrace, infuse both into that, so that the narrative itself reflects that, so it doesn't get too abstract and arid if you stay strictly with the rational. But it doesn't become this other thing if you give in to just the emotive response to all of this. So that's the central tension of my work here. And also there is something in history. It's really interesting how this is worked out. So you have racism. You have feminism, and you have something they call presentism, which is related to what I was just talking about, that you take the standards, the moral, ethical standards of your period, you apply them to an earlier period, and then you wag your finger and say, bad, 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 bad people, that you didn't live up to our standards, okay? So that is... You know, that pitfall is there too. So then you try to bring the events, the people to the surface, and you try to provide the context for why they believe and act as they do, okay? But you try to empathize with everyone concerned. Now, this book is not a melodrama of good Indians, bad white people. That's not what we're after here. This is not a Dee Brown Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, although there's tremendous value in that book, but that was reductive as far as I'm concerned in terms of the actual experience. That isn't respectful of the Indians, for one thing, to do that, to put them in that role as the good victims, okay? Because there was agency there, and that's one of the things that is handled in this book, is that the Kansa, as delimited as they were in living in a world of dwindling possibilities, were exercising agency in the ways that they were conducting themselves, the way they were trying to shape the policies, subsistence, practice of their culture, in all different kinds of ways. Personalities, leadership emerged that very bravely, I think, at times, tried to control events to the betterment of their people. Also, to add to the complexity of this, Elliot West has done some really fine work in Western American history, and he says, you know, the thing to remember is frontiers are messy, and implied in messy is complexity. Okay, there were a lot of times where white neighbors and Indian neighbors worked together, helped one another, developed friendships, treated each other decently. When during the Civil War in 1862-63, there were very few men available for to do the harvest. Who did the white farmers in the Council Grove area turn to? This is the reservation area south of Manhattan. It's at that time a 9-by-14 mile reservation. They recruited the Indians. And the government farmer at that time said, you know, they're... would not have been much of a harvest this year if it had not been for the Kansa coming in and helping the white farmers harvest the crops. Okay, women in particular This isn't going to surprise many. Women in particular seem to be able to cement positive relationships. There's some wonderful accounts in the memoirs of a lady by the name of Christina Phillips. She settled in the Salina area very early in 1858 had a post-trader store. And she had all kinds of Kansas Indian customers because they had their camps along the Saline River in that area at that time. And they got along beautifully. They were friends. And there's some very touching stories of the night before the Kansas were breaking camp and coming back to the reservation. They dropped in. The women came by Christina's trading post and gave her rings and jewelry and hugged her and told her how much they were going to miss her, and off they went. There are other instances like that, and they're in the book, okay? So it isn't all dark, but the darkest period, that phrase comes from Aligawahu's characterization of this period. Chief Aligawahu, head chief of the Kansas from 1867 until the Kansas were removed in 1873. That's how he characterized this period in a letter to the Secretary of the Department of the Interior in 1871. This is the darkest period in the history of our people. Okay, is how the translator phrased what he had said. Okay? Well, obviously there can be a lot more said here. I think what I'm going to do here is to read you just a couple of paragraphs from the book that it's our good fortune where the Euro-American observer saw the Kansas clearly, or as clearly as they could at that particular time. I cherish those. I cherish those because there aren't that many of them, actually. This is when there was a Quaker medical doctor who had been administering to the Shawnee Indians in the Shawnee Reservation near present-day Kansas City. And in October of 1852, he decided he wanted to go out to the Kansas Reservation near Council Grove because he heard that they were really wild Indians out there. And the Shawnee were pretty civilized, and he wanted to see what wild Indians looked like. And so he came out, and he crossed the Neosho River and stood on the west bank near some of you are familiar with Council Grove, close to where the Hayes House is today, actually the old Duckwalls building. And he looked back down into the stream here where a group of Kansas were crossing the stream. And there must have been quite a bit of a rainfall recently because the stream was flowing actually it was waist high. So he's looking back across this ford where a party of Kansas are crossing. The men quickly disrobed to their breechcloths and boldly waded through the waist-deep water. Hobbs, the fellow's name, attention, however, was focused on the women. They carefully lifted their skirts as they waded in to suit the depth, and as carefully dropped them as the water grew shallower toward the other shore. I carefully watched one who approached the crossing with two children in her arms, as her hands and arms were already employed. She stood the little ones in the shallow water near the shore and waded in the deeper water in front of them, where she squatted down in the water and fastened her clothing high up on her shoulders. She then reached for the children and moved on, gradually rising as the water grew deeper. When the water became shallower near the other shore, she began to squat and came lower and lower down until she could safely land the children. When she put them down in the water and loosed her skirts and let them drop as she straightened herself up and waded out without having wet her clothing or exposed her person. Now, a simple act of crossing a stream, but it's deceptively simple. It's amazing what she was able to pull off there. And the following paragraph basically expounds on that just a bit. Thanks to Hobbes, and without knowing what prompted his fascination, we are left with a description rare among Kansas-related historical documents. A detailed account of a Kansas person engaged in a necessary act of daily life. The event itself, fording the stream, is deceptively simple. In fact, the young mother confronted a number of important considerations requiring her to make intelligent decisions regarding how to keep her clothing dry on a cool October day, provide for the safety of her children while moving through a waist-deep current, which required physical strength and agility, and fulfill the cultural requirements of feminine modesty. At first glance, this scene is alien to the modern experience. After all, within 100 feet of this same crossing, young mothers today effortlessly drive over the Neosho River on a concrete bridge, their children strapped into the safety seats of SUVs. But the crossing of the young Kansas woman resonates with the experience of many modern women who each day protect their children, invent solutions to overcome myriad obstacles, and oblige cultural precepts of femininity. Her situation stirs our imaginations because it is both different and, in a broader sense, similar to that of our own. Just seeing people simply as people, doing necessary tasks. It's a breath of fresh air. Now, one other thing, and I'm going to close on this. In 1868, in June of 1868, the Cheyenne and the Kansas were engaged in a protracted struggle over bison hunting country in west central Kansas. Quite violent, and it really damaged the Kansas ability to subsist because they were highly dependent on the buffalo hunts. But the Cheyenne are caught up in this same descending cycle of diminishing resources that the Kansas and the Pawnees and all the other tribes were. So you can see where this pressure is enhancing the violence between the tribes. Well, okay, so the Cheyenne have felt outraged by the Kansas in an armed conflict near Larned. And so they come back into eastern Kansas, anywhere from 300 to 500 warriors. They march downtown Council Grove, and they go on out to the where the Kansas reservation is, to the southeast of Council Grove, and they align themselves up, and they prepare for battle. Well, there are only about 100, 110, 120 Kansas warriors. And the Euro-American observers at this time are saying, you know, it looks really bad for the Kansas. There is a guy by the name of Job Spencer. He used to be a Methodist minister, and he has become a post-trader out of the Kansas agency for this tribe. He's walking by with another fellow by the name of Huffaker right on the agency grounds, which is about a half mile behind the line where the Kansas warriors are dug in and their embankments on the west side of a stream called Little John. And the Cheyenne are arrayed on the hillside within 400, 500, 600 yards. And they're shooting at each other and shouting insults. But again, this appears to be a calamity in the making for the outnumbered and actually not nearly as well-armed Kansas. It appears to be. So this is Spencer's account. Judge Huffaker of Council Grove and myself passed near a group of women who were dancing on the grounds near the agency as the battle raged. As we passed, there was an old woman who looked at us, recognizing us, but no halt was made by the participants. Such an expression of earnestness, reverence, and solicitude I think I have never witnessed in anyone. She was in this act of worship invoking the help of Wakunda, the Supreme Being, in the then raging battle for her people's success. Her whole soul was enlisted in this act of worship. As her tribe was successful in the conflict, she doubtless felt that her efforts had been crowned with success, that the Great Spirit had been pleased with her service and had answered her intercessions. I have never felt more respect for the religious devotions of anyone than I did for that old heathen woman and her company of devotees. So I think I'm just going to chop it off. I know we're getting late here. I don't know, Michael. What do we do here in terms of time? Are we okay? All right. Sorry, I didn't allow time for questions. But thank you very much for your kind attention.
I might mention before we sing our closing hymn that this book has recently won both the Heritage Book Award for the best book about the heritage of the Great Trail Association, Trail Association's Lewis Berry Writing Award for the best book on the Santa Fe Trail and the making of the Santa Trail, and the Heritage Book Award. So there are two awards that he's recently received, and I expect that there will be more to come. Let us now stand as you are able, and if Pat and Dick would help us out with 407, we're going to sit at the welcome table. Okay. Here's an excerpt that I'd like to use for our closing words from the 1873 Council Grove Democrat paper, June 3rd. Kansas owes much to the cause of the Kansas Indians. Our state bears the name of its tribe, as well as the principal river. Our capital city, Topeka, we believe is a name derived from their language. They have in fact left their impress upon our state and have afforded us names for streams and towns all over it. And long after the cause shall have wrestled with the Great Spirit, their history will be perpetrated by association, if by no other means. But we also have Ron Park's book, so hallelujah.